Hello and welcome to the Neil Before Zod podcast. I'm Adam Levine and I'm joined by Lee Klontz. Lee?
Hi Adam, how are you?
Good, doing good. How are you?
I'm great, great to be here.
All right, we got some cool stuff to talk about today. We're going to talk about Batman versus Superman Ultimate Edition. We're going to talk about the movies that impacted us as little younglings. And we're going to go ahead and talk about some of the next-gen gaming systems that are coming out very soon. So we're going to dive right in, but a little quick housekeeping before we do that. Please follow us on Twitter at Zod Podcast and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, and Google Play. Thanks. All right, Lee, let's talk about Batman versus Superman. The Ultimate Edition was released within the last week. And I actually had not seen this film, so I thought, you know what? I'm going to just skip the theatrical version and watch the Ultimate Edition because there was so much hostility towards this film. I figured I'd give it its best opportunity to impress me. I know you saw it in the theaters, correct?
I did. I saw it in the theaters under this kind of cloud of low expectations. So I think I saw it the way... maybe it was best meant to be seen because I went in not expecting it to be very good. And I also saw it with two kids, so I have their perspective as well.
Now, were you like opening day or was this kind of like when it worked out for you?
I went opening weekend. We have a theater nearby which is open very early on a Sunday. And so it's very early to kind of go on opening weekend and see movies without the crowds.
Right.
So I did see it early on before I was spoiled about anything or knew a whole lot about what to expect. But I, of course, had seen the Rotten Tomatoes reviews by that point, which were pretty abysmal. I mean, they're, I think, still hovering around 30% right now, maybe less.
I just looked it up. Rotten Tomatoes is pulling at 27%. Users, 66%. So big disparity there. And on Metacritic, it's rocking a 44%. And for some reason, Metacritic uses a 10-point scale for users, but that's pulling a 7. So those numbers are relatively consistent with one another. Critics hated it a lot more than fans.
And, I mean, you know, even among fans, that's pretty bad. I mean, I don't think any of the Marvel movies have dipped anywhere near that low. Even something like the second Thor movie, which is pretty forgettable, or maybe The Incredible Hulk, none of them have quite fallen to those depths.
Absolutely. Okay, well, so let's dig in. Why don't you tell me, I get the sense you didn't like the film. Why don't you kind of put it in a nutshell? What did you not like about this film? And if I've got it all wrong and you love it, you can answer it that way if you prefer.
I think I went in really expecting it to be something truly horrible, like a kind of a Phantom Menace type disappointment, because, you know, as you did, I grew up reading the Dark Knight Returns and kind of understanding this kind of gritty Batman at the same time as this, as I also grown up watching the TV show and seeing this kind of fun, goofy Super Friends Batman. So The Batman cultural swing, I think, was something that was really kind of ingrained in my cultural history. So I felt like I was more prepared for this movie probably than certainly my kids were. What frustrated me so much about it is it felt like a rush. You know, it hit, and obviously, you know, we're going into spoiler territory here because it's been out for a while, but, you know, you go through the entire Batman versus Superman arc. You go through the Dark Knight Returns, you go through the Death of Superman storyline. I mean, we now have no more Clark Kent because he's clearly out of the picture for future Superman movies. This is all assuming Superman's coming back for Justice League, which we know he is. You know, Perry White, I guess, is gone. I mean, as weird as those scenes were, we've got no more Daily Planet, so that whole storyline is gone. Jimmy Olsen dies weirdly in the first couple minutes of the movie. So it's like there was this kind of rush to, like, establish this franchise and just do so much so fast. And I don't think a whole lot of it worked. It just felt kind of dour and depressing and kind of frustrating, and it wasn't any fun. And I'm not saying superhero movies have to be all fun, but I've never seen one that was so little fun before.
Okay. How did you feel, I maybe should have opened with this, how did you feel with about Batfleck?
I thought he was great. I think Ben Affleck is actually I think he's a terrific filmmaker. I think he is often a very engaging and fun actor. I think if you're looking for someone to play a kind of late career dour Superman, I think he did fine. I mean, he certainly did the workouts and drank his protein shakes, because the guy was built like a freaking brick wall. I don't know why they chose a Batman that was at the end of his career. I mean, what an uninteresting time to meet Batman when, you know, Joker has already killed Robin. And it's like they skipped so much that I wanted to see. I didn't need to see him at that level of his career. I didn't think that Ben Affleck was bad, though. Did he bother you?
No, actually, I actually thought he pretty much nailed it. You know, I think he's right there right away with, you know, Christian Bale as the most effective Batman, you know, that we've seen don the cape so far. So I was actually pleasantly surprised. I thought he inhabited that role quite well, and I completely agree with he was good for that sort of older Batman. And yes, I completely agree also with what you're saying, where they've skipped a lot of fertile years of the Batman, you know, history in that attempt to rush, and maybe that attempt to sort of try to get to that Dark Knight Batman in the Frank Miller comic, where he's actually much older, right? He's presumably in his 70s or 80s or something in that comic book. So they tried to play it a little bit close to that, to sort of capture, I think, some of the story elements there.
Yeah. What's weird about that to me is that the Dark Knight Returns takes place after Batman's career is over, after the Justice League is kind of disbanded. You know, part of the subtext of that comic is that, you know, everyone is kind of split up. You know, Green Lantern has gone back to the space, and the other heroes are kind of, they're all winding down too. And what's weird about Batman versus Superman is that they've got Batman kind of at this kind of end career point where he's burnt out and he's trying not to do the Batman thing anymore, and he's doing it kind of begrudgingly, and he's angry and he's lost so much. But the whole Justice League arc is just kicking off, and I you know, that is an interesting choice. I hope it is a choice that they made narratively and not just because they wanted to get to this popular storyline as fast as humanly possible.
Yeah, that's very possible. I guess it's worth mentioning, I could have led with this, the Ultimate Edition adds 30 minutes. So obviously they tried to shore up more of the story points that I know some people complained about. That said, this cut comes in at just over 3 hours. And that is, like, it was kind of an ordeal watching it. You know,
I felt kind of pummeled at the end of 2.5 hours, and, you know, everyone had to pee. So I can't imagine I get why they cut it, because a 3 hour movie with no intermission is pretty hard to pull off. But at the same time, the editing felt pretty jarring in the theatrical cut. I'm really looking forward to seeing the ultimate. Let me back up. I'm not really looking forward to seeing the Ultimate Edition cut, but I will see it, because I do want to see the movie in hopefully a more complete and whole state.
Yeah, I mean, having done so, I was sort of in my mind thinking, what would need to happen in this movie to get it to 2.5 hours, but without mauling the story? And, you know, there's a couple of takeaways I had. One of them was, and I know parts of this are in the theatrical story, obviously, where Lois gets involved with Jimmy Olsen. He's apparently CIA. They go to Africa. And this is all part of a Lex plot to ultimately impugn Superman by trying to attempt to say that he was part of what death his soldiers lay down at a village as they're kind of retreating. And that right there was, like, convoluted enough, but I thought that whole thing could come right out of the movie, like, so easily. you know, they could have excised everything that had to do with Africa. And I don't not only would it not have mattered, I actually think it would have made the plain narration point that they were trying to make of Superman destroying the city and pissing off Wayne and pissing off all the citizens. They sort of like pushed that aside with the Africa thing. That would have been the thing, and they use that guy who's the in the wheelchair as to keep that story arc going. But that arc was far more interesting than Africa, and the whole Africa thing fizzles out anyways because Lex has this giant ploy to essentially screw with Superman and Congress, only to blow up Congress, and that gets discovered very quickly. So it all becomes.
Yeah, the whole Africa sequence. Even I understand they did build that out in the ultimate cut, the theatrical cut. He doesn't burn the bodies. I understand that's something that they added into the new cut. So you just have these people that are all shot up, and it's a really strange kickoff. And they keep going back, and you have this this really boring plot line of Amy Adams kind of digging around for these, you know, specific kind of LexCorp bullets. It was completely unnecessary. You're absolutely right. And not only does it slow down the movie, but it doesn't even really make a lot of sense. I mean, it's I didn't understand why that sequence was even there, and it starts everything off slow, and then every time they go back to her sleuthing around, it's like, oh, who cares about these stupid bullets?
Right. And there were another sequences that I thought could have been left out of the movie as well, and you'll have to tell me which of these were actually in the theatrical. There were, I don't know, about four dream sequences that I made a note of in my brain as I was watching it. You know, one of them is in the opening title where he falls down the cave as a young boy and he gets lifted up by the bats, which was just literally batshit. There's that other one where older Bruce is in the Wayne crypt and it starts bleeding and he gets, you know, a bat monster thing pops up and like jumps at him. And then there's that really long one where he gets captured by like Superman's SS troops or whatever they are, you know, in that whole desert scene. And then there's the one where Superman has his little hike and he hangs out with his tin cup dad on a mountain. And it's like all of those scenes, you know, I'm sure they actually put some budget into them, but I thought all of them derailed the story. And I thought take those out too. And, you know, suddenly the narrative might have tightened up in a more palatable way.
They're awful. And I don't know, you know, I guess you're supposed to be kind of surprised to see Kevin Costner show back up. I don't know that anybody really missed seeing Kevin Costner in this movie, or would have felt any worse had he not been there. I want to talk a little more in a minute about kind of Superman's overall demeanor, and this goes back to Man of Steel. But the so-called the nightmare scene, you know, the kind of future view when Darkseid comes to Earth, and you've got the kind of what are they, the parademons, I believe they are, flying around in the desert.
Right.
None of that made any freaking sense, and then they layer on Flash coming from the future. It's just odd. It's and it doesn't add anything. And in the theater, my kids, when he started levitating at the beginning, they were like, "What's going on?" They thought that, you know, Batman was one of them. Asked me, "Is Batman have Superman's powers?" He asked me during the movie,
right?
At that sequence, and it's I think it's Zack Snyder just being kind of unable to rein himself in. He just loves visuals, and I think sometimes he will do things visually that don't make any sense narratively, and I think those scenes all kind of hit exactly that problem.
There was one scene, and it's really minor, but it kind of struck me as like, what's wrong with Zack Snyder and what was wrong with the script? There's a point where they're showing, you know, I'm a sports guy, right? So Metropolis is playing Gotham on television, and they show the score. Metropolis is up 58-0 on Gotham. I like stopped and wrote it down because I was like, just so like, this is such Zack Snyder garbage. So it shows the screen, it shows a play, and it says it's the fourth quarter, it's 3rd and 10, There's 1 second left in the game. Metropolis, again, remind you, is up 58 to nothing. They've got the ball, and their quarterback is dropping back on the pass and throwing into the end zone, like a 40-yard strike, which shows as a completion as the play shows out. And I'm like, okay, that would never happen. Right. Literally would never happen, but it shows that he just doesn't understand where lines are. Like, I kept after that, I wanted to see one more play in the game. Were they going to go for two to try to get it to, like, let's go for 66 nothing. It was just so, I think, just so emblematic of his inability to understand.
Yeah, and you know, that is an awesome metaphor. I don't remember that scene being in the original cut, but I could very well have missed it because it was a couple months ago. You know, I love The Watchmen. I think that's one of the great comic works of certainly my lifetime, and I've read it many times. And I was so almost satisfied with his movie cut, except it seemed like he didn't understand that the whole point of The Watchmen was that these weren't actual superheroes. They were human beings, except for Dr. Manhattan. These were human beings who were very well trained, you know, to fight, and who had really, they worked out. You see them in the comics, like working out and trying to be like physically capable of being superheroes. In the movie, everyone moves like a Zack Snyder, you know, superhuman. Even in kind of they survive things humans couldn't survive. They get their faces smashed through granite countertops, and they have like a bloody nose. you know, they do all kinds of slow motion jumps, and I'm like, wow, like you made this look like a comic book, but you don't actually understand narratively what's going on in this story. Like, these aren't supposed to be these people. You know, when Rorschach is fighting the cops, there shouldn't be this like Matrix looking fight. It should be like him gouging their eyes out and getting beaten with a baton. That's him. He can't seem to do anything in a way that is not, you know, a Hail Mary. Every scene has to be this kind of this painting. And I think there are times that really hurts him, and I think that really hurts this movie.
Well, Lee, I got bad news for you. It's Zack Snyder's world, and you're locked in there with him.
That's true. No, it really is true. And I've watched, I think, everything he's made. I watched Sucker Punch, even.
Oh, that was such shite.
Man. I know, but how much work did he put into making it be awful? You know, like, yeah. He really was trying to do something, and I do have to kind of admire that, because visually, I mean, he's astounding. I just wish someone could kind of control his vision a little bit, because I think if properly reined in, he could be amazing. He could make a truly great film, but this isn't it, and he hasn't quite figured it out yet.
Yeah, I just wanted to briefly talk about the scene you actually already referred to, the, we'll call it the flashback, flash forward, whatever you want to call it, where the Flash pops in after one of those dream sequences, and he's like, you know, gives sort of a slightly cryptic message about, you know, Lois is the key. Mm-hmm. And man, that scene was like, that's like a perfect example of a scene that's handled poorly, and now they have to double down on it and justify it in a future movie.
Yep.
Like, that's what I hate when they do that. Like, that, yep, scene was shit. You don't know, frankly, if he's talking the context of the movie events, which wouldn't surprise me since most people don't know that universe very well and can't be expected to, or if it's setting up more of the Darkseid and Infinite Crisis. You know, those IPs could be coming into play. But either way, like, what a terrible way to introduce the Flash in a scene where you're like, what is he talking about? And I always hate it when characters like act the fool. So Flash obviously has the power to like kind of pop around in time, and obviously they're showing that he can only do it for a few seconds. Don't you think you'd get your shit together and have your message together if you're gonna like if really kind of like practice it maybe a couple times, go, okay, I'm gonna be really, this is, you know, Wonder Woman, does this sound good? This is what I'm gonna tell Batman in the past at some point. I just, that really annoyed me. And the introduction of the rest of the team members, Cyborg, Aquaman, obviously Wonder Woman. Wonder Woman actually I think was successful. How they handled the other three, the Flash, the Cyborg, and Aquaman, I thought was really kind of heavy-handed and silly.
And, oh, it's terrible.
And the way they did it, you're like, you kept thinking, is, are they going to pop up at the end of this movie? Like when Lois was underwater looking for the spear, I was like, is Aquaman going to pop out? You know, are we going to see Flash zip in at the end and say, hey, guys, sorry I'm late? You know, they just handled that really strangely.
Yeah, I mean, the fact that the spear falls into water, I was like, okay, here comes Aquaman.
Right.
Like, clearly we're going to get some payoff for that really, really half-assed scene where she's, like, reading the emails and seeing these. It's like, you know, the Justice League website that he sent her, that, you know, with the icons. Like, that was really awful. But I thought we'd get some payoff for that with some kind of something at the end. Because frankly, we'd seen the entire closing fight in the trailer. There wasn't really anything except for the magic lasso, which I thought was kind of cool. The entire Wonder Woman reveal was given up in the trailer. And most of that fight was just kind of uninteresting. And honestly, it looked like a video game and not like a particularly good one.
Well, that may be their best destiny, is to continue cranking out good fighting games for the DC Universe, because on the movie front, the struggle continues.
Yeah, and I mean, I really, you know, having watched Man of Steel maybe two or three times and seeing this, I don't like this take on Superman. I think Henry Cavill looks as much like Superman as anyone, certainly since Christopher Reeve, and maybe even more so. But I don't like this dour, depressed, sad Superman. Superman is supposed to be a balance to Batman. You know, Batman's supposed to be the cynical kind of realist, and Superman is supposed to be the kind of eternal optimist and the kind of carrier of these kind of values that, you know, that people are worth saving. And Batman's supposed to be like, no, they're not. And Superman's supposed to be, no, they are. And he's supposed to kind of, they work together to be heroes. I feel like Superman just seems kind of glum and depressed, and I could handle that for the first movie. I was really surprised to see how unhappy he seemed to be being Superman in this movie.
Yeah, I'm with you. And I think a lot of that traces back that the path that character got put on at the end of Man of Steel, where he essentially murders Zod, right? That was completely out of character for the Superman we grew up reading and seeing in other formats. Like, Superman would never do that. Superman would find another solution to that problem, you know, whether build a new Phantom Zone, yeah, or strand him somewhere or put him in stasis, do something other than snap his neck like, you know, pretty much a monster would. And once they went down that road, you know, once they rang that bell, which is one of the jokes Lex makes when he talks about, you know, teasing Darkseid, you know, you can't unring it, and they can't. So I don't know. That's a big problem. What did you think of Lex Luthor and
I think that when the Razzies come around this year and are looking to name a worst supporting actor, I think Jesse Eisenberg is probably on the short list. I thought he was horrible, horrible. I mean, and I get that he was doing what Zack Snyder wanted him to do, but it may be the worst take on Lex Luthor I could possibly imagine. I hated him.
Yeah.
Deeply.
Yeah. The whole sort of like goofy, neurotic Lex, that just doesn't at all align with how I see Lex Luthor in my head, where I see him as like very cerebral and stable and sinister. You know, that's Lex Luthor to me. You know, not this like kind of neurotic nutball who creates plans that leave you scratching your head, like, you know, why set up Superman in Congress when you're going to blow up Congress? Why set up Superman to fight Batman when you're going to unleash Doomsday? Like, what is...
Yeah, I mean, honestly, none of his ambition made a whole lot of sense. I didn't think he was well-written. his kind of general demeanor was just kind of annoying more than it was scary. And it's funny because we've had so many interesting takes on that character with, Gene Hackman, I think, being, my kind of definitive Lex Luthor. But, Michael Rosenberg on the on Smallville, I thought had a really interesting take. I mean, he's interesting to watch and it's different. I Kevin Spacey was kind of hammy and that's fine. I mean, but none of them. I mean, this was more like the Riddler than it was like any kind of Lex Luthor I've ever seen. And I don't think it's just because it wasn't what I wanted. I really think it's because it was genuinely awful.
I don't even know if this is worth talking about because it's such a just a another big mic drop disaster in the film is the whole Martha scene, Martha, why did you say that name? And then somehow that's the moment of clarity where they decide to listen to each other as heroes and not combatants. Man, man, oh man. I don't think there's any saving that scene. I don't even know if you could edit it out without that scene falling apart too. Like, again, I'm just thinking about how to chop the movie up and make it better. I think you'd literally have to reshoot that and go.
Well, the thing that I think makes that scene work in The Dark Knight Returns is basically, Batman finally, he kicks Superman's ass, and when Superman's finally beaten, I'm sure you remember, he has a heart attack, and Superman is beaten, but he's survived. He takes Bruce, he buries him, he realizes right as he's buried him that it was actually faked, and he's actually still okay. And then he kind of they agree to kind of live these separate lives for, well, until the sequel, which was just god awful. We can talk about that another time. But at the end of The Dark Knight Returns, there's kind of this expectation that, they're back at equilibrium. They've kind of reached a good place. You can only do that when you have a history and a friendship, and there's a understanding of each character to fall back on. So I think with this, the way this movie was architected narratively, I guess they didn't know what to do. And I think the Martha thing is totally stupid. I don't know how else you get out of that fight except to realize, like, hey, this is a really dumb fight. Why are we fighting each other? Because Lex Luthor is, like, why didn't Superman just say, like, hey, Lex Luthor has my mom, let's go get him, that scene is, everybody thinks that scene is terrible, and it is. But it's really the fault, I think, of the arc that they put those characters on.
I guess in the recut I have in my head, somehow their fight wouldn't have come to a conclusion, but the Doomsday fight would have started and that would have ended their fight. That's the only way I think. Like, I actually think there's like a 2-hour and 15-minute cut of this film that could be decent. So, Zack Snyder, if you're listening, I think I
Well, you're right though, but I mean, Superman is out of character in terms of killing Zod in Man of Steel. But then you have his dad telling him, like, yeah, maybe you should have let that bus full of kids drown to save your identity. Maybe that would have been a smart thing to do. So it's like, well, okay, so maybe this kid was just raised wrong. But then you have Batman going on like a murder spree to get the kryptonite, driving the Batmobile over cars and just grinding people up and branding them so they're killed in prison. So Batman is also supposed to have some kind of a code that this movie just kind of ignores. I don't know. It's a very it's almost kind of a nihilistic movie, and I'm not saying that superhero movies have to be all like fun and light. I can certainly handle a gritty superhero movie, but this movie, I'm not asking for super friends, but I don't know what it's going to be like to see these two guys with Wonder Woman and Cyborg, and maybe eventually Green Lantern and Flash, hanging out on the Justice League satellite or whatever. Like, I don't know what that's going to be like to see them hanging out together because they all seem so frigging depressed. I really hope that they can kind of lighten these things up a little bit because right now it's just gloomy and grim.
Well, maybe they need a Xanax and a new director and a couple new scripts, and maybe there's some hope, but
God, I hope so.
maybe
I
not.
hope so.
Okay, well, I'd say we've put bats and soup stuff.
All right.
Okay, in this segment, we're going to do a thematic little device. We're going to call it Movies That Impacted Youngling Me. So these are movies that, for me, actually, for the most part, not to completely date myself, but these are when I was just a little kid, preteen era, films that I got to see that had a really big impact on sort of my love of movies and my perception of, you know, the caliber of the imagination that was being presented in these things, and very inspirational to me this day. We're going to both do, I think, a list of five, and these are five movies that I think we both really, really love. And we'll get it started. Why don't you give us your first one, Lee?
So I actually have, if you came to my office, I have a movie theater poster of The Black Hole in my office. The Black Hole for me was a real moment. It was probably the most adult film I'd ever seen at the time. I was probably 6 or 7. I suspect that my dad took me to see it thinking that it was like another Star Warsy kind of movie, because I love space movies. And you end up with this movie that's kind of this grim rumination on death and on kind of our place in the universe, and how, you know, you've got this ghost ship, like, you know, teetering on the precipice of this, like, you know, kind of metaphysical destruction, staffed by animated reanimated zombies. And then you've got this scene at the end, which I understood later was kind of a ripoff of 2001, but that, you know, basically sent the villain, like, quite literally, like, to hell, you know, trapped inside of this kind of creation, the Maximilian robot that he'd created. And as I think about movies, I mean, I sit there every day in my office as I'm working, and I have this gigantic poster on my wall, and sometimes people ask about it, and that movie really affected me. I mean, it hasn't really held up all that well in terms of the pretty amateurish effects and kind of horrible acting, but but it has a certain kind of magic that has really stuck with me over time.
I too love The Black Hole. It did not make my list, but actually, funny enough, I too have a Black Hole poster. It's not an original movie poster. It's one of these, I feel bad, I can't remember the artist's name, but I paid him some money. He did like kind of a retro print of it. It's awesome. I'll remind me to send you a picture of it. It's super cool. But yeah, I'm with you on The Black Hole. I was so into Maximilian. When he like has kind of his baller scene where he like kills a few people with his little spinning blade. Like, that's just some badass stuff. I have like a distinct memory of always wanting to see Maximilian go against Vader and see how that, you know, right, in theory Vader would like just carve him into a pumpkin pie really quickly, but I always wanted to see that brawl.
Yeah, I mean, it's a really interesting movie, because at the end of the movie, the heroes escape, you know, destruction on this ship, which somehow has been inoculated against the effects of a black hole, which I don't get it, but whatever.
That's anti-gravity tech, yo.
Yeah, exactly. So it somehow is able to go through the black hole, comes out the other side, and they are somewhere. I mean, they're going to die because they don't have any food, and they're on this ship. You've got these people that are on this kind of you know, this voyage of discovery, even though they're not going to survive it. So it even ends in this like incredibly bleak way that is kind of fitting the mood of the entire film heretofore. But it's actually a really great, it's the only ending that makes any sense, because there's no way they can get away. I mean, that's the whole point, is the black hole is inescapable. And I kind of love that even at the end, it didn't really back down from that.
Fun fact, I'm pretty sure I had a black hole comic book that continued the series, and they do make it through to the other side of the black hole, which of course we now know probably isn't very likely.
So the beyond the fun the fun fact is that it was actually called Beyond the Black Hole.
There you go.
And what's really like amateurish and sad about it is what they meet is a mirror version of the Cygnus. So it's it the I think it was a Marvel comic. I don't actually remember who did the comic, but whoever did the comic was so half-assed that they didn't come up with any new villains. They just basically said, yeah, they meet the mirror universe version of what they just saw. So yes, you're right. I don't know if that's actually canon, but there was a follow-up comic.
All right.
How
Okay,
about
so
you?
the first on my list is Empire Strikes Back. That was, as far as I can recollect, the first movie I remember seeing as a kid lining up opening day, waiting, this before the good old days of pre-assigned seats, we were, I think, waiting outside for like 3 hours to go see the third or fourth showing of the day. And I'd seen Star Wars, but I didn't see that remotely when my parents took me to see it. It had been out for quite some time, but Empire, I was all in and, out in line waiting, and I just, that was like a big, continuation of a story that, you had to wait 3 years to see, and Vader and, the cliffhanger. That's just a great movie, and thank God George Lucas didn't direct it.
Yeah. I mean, maybe the most satisfying sequel ever. I
Yeah.
mean,
Here's my fun fact for that. The director, speaking of directors, Irvin Kershner also directed RoboCop 2.
yeah, I
Which
hate RoboCop 2.
RoboCop 2 is kind of a giant mess, but it's kind of a genius, like crazy giant mess.
Yeah.
Like there are elements of that film that I find like very admirable, even though it doesn't work at all.
No. You know who wrote RoboCop 2? Frank Miller.
Frank Miller, that's right.
Yeah, so I mean I think that tells you all you need to know about the kind of nihilistic quality of this movie. Yeah, you know, it's funny you had the same experience with Empire Strikes Back I did. My dad and I, we waited in line. There were no Fandango advance tickets. My cousin actually got in before me. He was ahead of me in line. He didn't let me cut. So he was actually inside the theater. Like I remember sitting there watching him through the glass, And I mean, what a movie, right? I mean, The Empire Strikes Back really, I mean, I think expanded the Star Wars universe fundamentally in ways that probably none of the other sequels have. I mean, it took this kind of tight little story about, good guys versus bad guys and totally blew it open and in a way that felt completely authentic and real. It may be the greatest sequel of all time. So for me, as I think about movies that really had an impact on me as a young person, and I was a little bit older than the previous two movies, but I really loved Labyrinth. The Jim Henson George Lucas collaboration for a couple of reasons. One is it's a really clever kind of funny movie about the kind of the bridge between childhood and adulthood. I mean, that's really what the movie's about at a time when I was moving from childhood to adulthood, and so I think I really kind of felt that pull in both directions, like both the hey, funny puppets and, little songs, but also this kind of like, what's on the other side of this? I don't actually know yet. And also, I think Jennifer Connelly probably brought me fully into puberty in a way that I have to acknowledge. I mean, I remember just watching that movie just to watch her because, she was for I think there was like a trifecta of Jennifer Connelly movies in the mid 80s. It was Labyrinth, Career Opportunities, which terrible movie, but it was kind of a basically an hour and 30-minute Target ad, and The Rocketeer,
Yeah.
which is still a great movie. But like she had this kind of like very kind of classical, kind of almost kind of 1950s pinup kind of beauty that really kind of like it was like wow, like I think she was the first kind of woman I ever noticed as like a woman, and so that movie kind of always has stuck with me because it like not to read too much into kind of the subtext of these things, but it's like, you know, both as the movie kind of was about this bridge, you know, it also was kind of like, you know, I was like kind of noticing girls for the first time watching this movie. And that was kind of, has kind of given it always a very kind of soft spot in my heart.
Okay. Well, while you were enjoying your David Bowie and your Muppets and, your Jennifer Connelly awakening, I was watching Excalibur.
Oh, great movie.
Which was a movie I'm not really sure why I was taken to. I'm pretty sure that was rated R, and I was 10 or 11 at the time. But that movie, you know, that really had a big impact on me, too. I just, everything about that movie I loved. I think at that point I was, like, you know, reading, you know, that sort of fantasy mm-hmm. stuff and King Arthur and, you know, swords and sorcery and, you know, men hacking each other's limbs off in battlefields. You know, I was all in on that film. And I actually think that movie stands up pretty well, mm-hmm. You know, which is, you know, not a lot of things can say that from that, you know, that are, what, 30 years old now. And that was directed by John Boorman, who also, I have two fun facts for this one. One, he also directed Deliverance. Mm-hmm. Sui! And Excalibur, I noted, because it jumped right off the screen to me, was appeared in Batman versus Superman when they're doing the flashback.
You're correct.
You know, it's on the marquee as Bruce's parents get gunned down. So I guess that makes me think Zack Snyder also loves Excalibur. So thumbs up if that's true, Zach. You got that part right. Good for you.
It is such a physical movie. And it's interesting that there are movies from that era that do hold up because they're almost like before special effects, before they were able to do a lot of things with special effects, so they had to do them physically. And so, you know, you're watching these guys just beating themselves up and you're watching actual like liquid, obviously it's fake blood, but I mean, there's something actually coming out of them. It's not like a 300, you know, Zack Snyder again, where it's digital blood. I mean, these people really look like they're hurt. And I mean, that movie I think holds up in large respect because, you know, the fights feel very visceral and real. I'd say another fun fact about that movie is John Boorman's daughter played Egraine.
That's right.
So the really kind of uncomfortable scene now where she is intimate. She's being intimate with a knight in full armor, which is a really peculiar scene. Was, you know, her father directing her completely stark naked, having a moment with someone wearing a full suit of armor, which I don't think has ever been in a film since. So.
Yeah, not creepy at all, but job well done.
Good job absolutely well done. So, you know, in a similar vein, in the kind of fantasy vein, I, as a kid, I loved Krull. I thought, and I know it's not a very good movie. It's the point where special effects had started to do things they really weren't quite ready to do yet, which is why it doesn't hold up as well. But I loved it for a couple of reasons. One is, you know, just the sheer willingness to try a really wide variety of kind of sci-fi tropes and fantasy tropes and action tropes and kind of mix them all into one movie and to do it even knowing that they couldn't quite pull it all off. And I think as a movie, it definitely feels dated. But it's
you think,
but it, you know, the other thing about it that is kind of interesting looking back is it was kind of a multimedia film. It was one of the first films that had the movie and it had a comic book and it had a video game.
Yeah.
And they all came out about the same time and they all kind of gave you this, like, you know, the video game's fantastic. And they all kind of fed together to kind of give this experience that was, I mean, now we take it for granted. We expect that everything attacks us from every different media direction. But with Krull, it was pretty new. And I think in its own way, it was pretty successful and pretty, pretty innovative.
Yeah. The one thing I remember the most about Kroll, and this is sort of your Jennifer Connelly moment, touch point. Mine is Lisette Anthony,
Oh,
who
yes.
plays the. She's just a beautiful, beautiful woman in that film, and I remember that had an impact on me. So there you go.
Absolutely. I remember thinking about the glaive. There is no way you could actually catch the glaive without shearing your entire hand off. I have no
Yeah,
idea.
that was the worst weapon on the planet. It worked as like a video game, but like practically when that thing came back, you were going to lose a limb.
But dude, it looked cool. It looks super cool.
Okay, so speaking of losing limbs, again, while you were having fun with Crawl, I was, and I know this was probably on your list or high on your list, of course, is Conan the Barbarian.
Ugh.
Which, like, the first time you see that as a kid, you're like, oh my god. So this is what, like, a hard R action movie looks like. You know, that's, like, no holds barred. And the first time I saw that, I was like, oh my god, that was amazing.
So good.
And I'm pretty sure there's no way I saw that in the theater. I think I saw that on home video. Maybe, you know, whatever it took to release a year later on video. But that made a strong impression.
Such a great movie.
Yeah, and that, you know, I think arguably his best work, only because he doesn't have to speak hardly at all in the film. You know, he has a very physical, imposing character to play who doesn't speak much. I think that was, like, absolutely perfect for Arnold at that point.
Well, and I think it's a lot like Excalibur in that, again, it's so, you know, it's so physical because they couldn't fake a lot of it. They really had to fight each other. I mean, there's clearly, you know, people falling off horses, and there are people, you know, fighting with swords, and there are people punching each other. And it's like there's a real kind of authenticity to that movie that that makes it very much a classic and very much, you know, very watchable even today. I absolutely love that movie.
Yeah, and it was just a movie that I think really a lot of movies fail on this point. It understood that the villain had to be a really good actor and have some development to their storyline. And the whole James Earl Jones, you know, is just he just nails it.
Yeah, I mean, he was just a conqueror and a cult leader. I mean, he didn't have anything against Conan as a person, and in fact, I mean, I think he kind of admired him at the end. And you know, I love how rich that whole movie is. I mean, you look at it and you think of it as kind of a just a, you know, Beastmaster kind of action movie, but it's actually it's a really well-made movie, and the music is fantastic, and the it's very well edited. I mean, I think you only need look at the sequel to see how it could have gone, because, you know, Conan the Destroyer is just embarrassing, and it's corny, and it's silly, and it's cheesy, and it's PG, you know, and it
that movie eternally needs to contemplate its sins on the tree of.
That's right. That's right. But it's, you know, like Conan was a very unflinching movie, and it's so strong for that unflinchingness. Love that movie. Love it.
Okay. What do you got next on your list?
So, you know, we talked earlier about Batman versus Superman, and one of the things that I, after I saw that movie, I ended up watching a long segment of the original Richard Donner Superman movie, which, you know, I loved as a kid, as probably you did as well. And it really reminded me of why I was so frustrated with the kind of the modern view of Superman, because, you know, I don't know that any movie has ever understood its source material as well as Superman the movie. You know, obviously it has all the special effects, and it has the, you know, the rear projection flying doesn't hold up all that well today, but it's still completely sufficient. But you have this amazing inhabitation of that character by Christopher Reeve, who, it's funny, you look at him now and he's not particularly like muscular in the way that we, you know, look at, Ben Affleck in Batman vs. Superman, or certainly Henry Cavill, or even Matt Damon in the new Bourne movie, you know, who looks like, you know, Lou Ferrigno did as the Hulk, you know, I mean, but Christopher Reeve, like, was so much a real, he was Superman. Like, I really did believe a man could fly, to be corny about it. I mean, that movie promised a lot, and it delivered so much to me when I was 7 or 8 years old. Love that movie.
Yeah, that's another gem. Let's see. Next on my list is Mad Max 2: The Road Warrior, which, directed by George Miller, who has now gone on and upped his own ante with Fury Road, and I think I believe he's directing the sequel to that, Mad Max Wasteland or something like that. But yeah, the Road Warrior was like another one of those, like, I guess there's a theme here on all my films. It was just like super visceral, and it had these like amazing practical stunts. The whole car chase at the end, where they're trying to get away with the oil, presumably, and the action's great. It's obviously, that movie's a little bit let down by some of the acting and some of the costumes and maybe some of the dialogue that happens in the first like half of it, but that's just a really fun film to this day.
Yeah, I haven't actually revisited that one in a long time. I did see it as a kid. The memory that I've never been able to escape is the guy getting his fingers lopped off by the boomerang. But I have such admiration for the modern Mad Max movie that I do feel like I owe it a contemporary viewing, because I remember being very affected by it as a kid.
Yeah, I think you'll find it's certainly not perfect, but it's still a good watch.
Nice. I think my fifth movie, and this is maybe an obvious one, but I watched a couple of months ago Raiders of the Lost Ark with my kids. Yeah, right. And it a couple things popped up. I mean, obviously it's a great movie. We all know it's a great movie, but it occurred to me how different a movie it is from all of the sequels. I mean, it's easy to throw the Crystal Skull kind of out. I mean, nobody loves that movie, but it is such a gritty, again, visceral kind of action film. I mean, there's no silliness in it. I mean, if you look at Temple of Doom, if you look at Last Crusade, if you look at Crystal Skull, there's this kind of lightness and kind of fun kind of kind of serial kind of hokiness. Raiders doesn't truck with any of that. Raiders is actually a pretty intense movie throughout, and a pretty adult movie throughout. And they really pivoted from that in the sequels. Actually, all of them. I actually watching Raiders made me like all of the sequels less, because it is such a strong movie and such a powerful movie. I'm not one of those people that says that, I wish they'd never made the sequels, or I wish that, the prequels never made. I don't think that the absence of a subsequent movie makes a previous movie weaker. But watching Raiders kind of in solitude, that movie is pretty amazing. And again, it's one of those movies that holds up incredibly well.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's clearly Spielberg's masterwork. I don't think anything he did after or before kind of just reached the perfection that that film is, and didn't make my list, but it is absolutely one of my 10 favorite films of all time, without a doubt. One of the greatest action films of all time, absolutely.
Well,
Yeah.
and can I tell you, I know I probably am more of a George Lucas apologist than I really should be, but it's also George Lucas's Star Wars is obviously his masterpiece, but it is exactly how you have to treat George Lucas, which is like as this kind of this font of ideas from which you draw only the best, and then you just kind of like push away the worst, because if you let George Lucas do too much, he will completely ruin anything. I think that the mixture of Lucas and Spielberg in that movie, it was alchemy. I mean, they really found the perfect kind of combination there, and what a great movie. I mean, so much has been said about it, but to go back and watch it with people who have never watched it before, it's an astounding piece of work.
Absolutely. Completely agree. All right, my fifth and final film. was a movie I saw as a double feature with the Mad Max 2 Road Warrior, and this was Blade Runner. So this was a double feature that young me sat down to watch in the summer of 1982, and it blew me away watching those two films back to back.
Yeah, I bet.
You know, I'm pretty sure Mad Max played first, you know, and I'm like, wow, that was really, really good. And then boom, up comes Blade Runner, which, you know, there's a lot of opinions on Blade Runner, but the artistry and the impact of just sitting in a theater and watching that film, and if you've never seen Blade Runner in a movie theater, I strongly, strongly put that on your bucket list. It's just an amazing experience, and I was already, you know, more than predisposed to love science fiction, and just seeing that world, and you know, Harrison Ford, who I already loved, you know, from Star Wars, and you know, and later with Raiders, and it's hard not to imagine that if I actually sat down and truly ranked films, Blade Runner's probably still on top. It's been my number one a lot, and it's just a movie that speaks to me on so many different levels. I love the music, I love the story. I don't love that there are multiple versions of it, and maybe that's a conversation for another time, but you know, because I'm in this world where I watched that movie so many times with the, you know, the version that Ridley Scott didn't want out there, where, you know, where they were forced to have the voiceover work, you know, to explain, I suppose, to people what was happening, who couldn't piece it together. And I completely understand that they didn't want to do that, and you know, Harrison Ford deadpanned it. But seeing that so many times, that's the version in my head, no matter what director's version has been released since. And that's what troubles me about this film being my, you know, potentially my favorite of all time, is there's always going to be that conflict between the two different versions. And that's not some subtle, you know, Greedo shot first shit. You know, this is like kind of a big deal.
No, it's a fascinating movie, and the pacing is so different from anything that would ever come out today. It's not, you know, it's not an action movie. It's a real slow burn of a movie. I love it too. I've seen it many times and really love it.
We'll see what they do with the sequel.
Yeah.
That could either just shatter my childhood, or, you know, renew my faith that, you know, that he had the version right the second time around. We'll see.
Maybe I should see it first and throw myself in front of the bus if it's not good. Okay, so E3 was in the past couple weeks, and one of the things that I thought was as interesting as what was there was what wasn't there, and that's the next generation of hardware. And everyone knows that there are some new consoles coming out, it's a little different from generations of old. We see Nintendo with this mysterious Nintendo NX that's coming out, I think, as soon as March, they're saying, but they haven't shown anything yet. We have PlayStation, we have Sony iterating the PlayStation line with the PS4 Neo, which will offer a slightly faster processor, some enhanced visuals in games, and 4K output for Blu-ray. And then we have Microsoft iterating the Xbox One with a slimmer version that can do 4K Blu-ray output, and then a tease toward next year, the Scorpio, which will be a new console, but one that will be completely backwards compatible with existing Xbox One and backwards compatible Xbox 360 games. So, Adam, what do you think? I mean, are we shortening the generations too much, or is this just a sign of technology improvements making gaming better?
Well, I think we're caught in this weird 4K vortex. I've seen figures that suggest that market penetration on 4K has been very good in the last year. A lot of people are buying these TV sets, and I think the gaming companies are sort of wanting to, you know, get an attach rate on that new market, right? Because I think, what did I saw really, there was a really high attach rate so far between people who've bought 4K sets and then people who then went out and bought a 4K Blu-ray player. There's very shortly going to be three on the market. There's a Samsung, a Panasonic, and a Philips. And both, you know, the Xbox One S and Scorpio, And the Neo, well, presumably Neo is going to have a Blu-ray playback. We don't know that for a fact, but both the Xbox products are going to. And they're suddenly going to be probably the cheapest option on the market just to get a player. So then if you can throw in a gaming system, you know, or a console, you know, that is designed to stream these 4K apps and or enhance your games, that becomes a pretty interesting value proposition for people. So I think they're kind of rushing to get first there. And we'll see who's successful with that strategy. But I feel like that's driving it more than it's time for the evolution in the gaming console.
Well, so, but you're right. And what I wonder is if the boards have really been pretty hard on Sony in particular about coming out with a new PlayStation 4 so early that will enhance existing games in ways that they're not completely articulating yet. So, I mean, we've got a little more graphics horsepower, a little more processing horsepower. So publishers can now go back. If you know, say The Last of Us, if there were scenes that had some chug, they can go back and fix that for the Neo. And a lot of people are saying that that's effectively making the PS4 classic, if you will, a second-class citizen. As someone who owns a PS4, is that something you're concerned about? Are you feeling like you've got to rush out and buy the new Neo? I mean, I know you probably want one for the 4K Blu-ray, but would you buy one for the gaming enhancements?
Well, I haven't yet purchased a 4K set, although it's something I want to do soon. I feel it's time to upgrade from my Panasonic Plasma. I think there's enough reason to do it now. You can get some 4K channels on DirecTV, 4K UHD discs from what I've seen, you know, just in very limited supply, or look amazing. And I'm a very...
I hear Deadpool is one that you must see on 4K.
That exactly. So there's already a handful of those discs, so that I always kind of like being out in front of that stuff. That said, I haven't moved on it. You know, I think ultimately if either the Xbox or PlayStation can handle also being a player, and so you don't have to get a player and you can immediately upgrade your gaming rig, you know, I think that's a pretty good deal. I think like the bottom line Xbox One S, which, you know, is coming this year, I think maybe August at some point, that's got a UHD player and I've got a 4K set at that point, that becomes really compelling because I'm going to want a movie player. So, you know, if I can upgrade my Xbox, that's great. Now, all of that said, I think one of the cool things about these 4K sets is a lot of them do a very good job of upgrading current 1080p content, making it look better. So I'm not sure, you know, the delta between those two is going to be so significant. And I feel like the gaming companies, I think, are kind of setting up a problem for themselves, because it's like you said, like if someone's like, well, if I bought, you know, the new God of War game, is it that much better is the Neo version that much better that I'm kind of getting screwed buying it for my PS4 regular? You know, should I upgrade? Is one better? Does that start to create problems for game developers? You know, like, you used to think back to like when there were like all these handheld systems and a game would come out and there'd be like six versions of it. I don't think that's particularly easy to develop for or a good thing for gaming companies to have to deal with. So if the spec comes down from Microsoft or Sony and says, well, we'd like you to develop a 4K optimized version of your game, I don't know, I could see that presenting some challenges for developers and creating kind of market confusion.
Yeah, I think the thing that has also made things challenging is the approach of VR, because none of the existing consoles have the horsepower to put out truly vomit-proof VR. I've, you know, played with the Oculus Rift on some less than ideal hardware, and, you know, the nausea problem is a real problem, and you really need a very high frame rate and a very low lag kind of movement response. And so, you know, I think a big part of the Neo is around making the PlayStation VR a success, but Sony is catching a lot more grief than Microsoft, it seems. Maybe it's because Microsoft is not their Scorpio plans are still so far off that people don't feel quite as trapped right now. I mean, if you were thinking about buying a PlayStation 4 today, that'd be a tough choice to make, right? Because, I mean, the Neo will presumably come in at a slightly higher price point, but it's hard to imagine that the old PlayStation has a very long life, right? New games will certainly be Neo enhanced, and probably most old games as well will get some touch up. And then if you ever want to play VR, then you probably want to get a Neo. But it does feel like we're at this kind of weird place where this generation of consoles launched not quite powerful enough for the technologies of their day, right? They're not quite powerful enough for VR. They're not quite powerful enough for 4K. So they're getting this kind of mid-generation relaunch. And it'll be interesting to see if they can actually pull that off.
Yeah, I mean, I think those two things you mentioned are really key. One being the VR, right? There's, you know, the Rift, like you said, the Vibe. PlayStation has a headset that's coming out. You know, Samsung is in that market. Google Cardboard is in that market. You know, everybody's trying to get into VR as the next sort of cash cow, and it remains to be seen whether it's going to hit or not. It probably has a better chance than, say, something as wonky as 3D did, but I don't know. I'm not sold on VR. Like, can you imagine if you have a PlayStation Neo, or even if they somehow made a regular PlayStation, if they were able to squeeze VR working out of that, and you're sitting on your couch in front of your PlayStation, in front of like a really nice television set, and you're going to slap on a headset? I don't get that. And then your friends come over, and like, what, they all have to have headsets too? I just don't see that scaling very well. It doesn't seem like it's ever going to be the best screen in your house, and it's never going to scale. You know, like, what, are your kids going to fight over the one VR headset you have? You're going to start having like two or three of these at $400 to $600 a pop, or whatever they come into? It seems like there's too many kind of problems with that tech.
Yeah, I am also not convinced. I have friends who are, you know, true believers, and really, you know, they're ready to basically do the Ready Player One, you know, live inside a VR lifestyle, because, you know, according to what they've seen, it on proper hardware and with, you know, truly great software, you know, it's apparently a very engrossing experience. But what I've seen has been very, very much a novelty. And, you know, honestly, most of the games I've seen for VR have been glorified kind of tech demos. Like, yeah, okay, yeah, you can stand there and zombies come at you, and it's kind of exciting, but it reminds me kind of like the Wii. It's like, for most of us, it's fun for a very little while, and people come over and want to try it, but it's not something that has a lot of legs as a everyday gaming experience. So I don't know. I'm still pretty bearish on the whole VR movement, but I'm also very interested as well. I think it could be really compelling down the road, but I'm not sure this generation is quite ready for it yet.
Yeah, I think we're still living in a time where gaming is still, you know, sort of systemically a passive experience, where you're sitting there with a controller in your hand, headset or not, and you're just kind of doing your thing. I think ultimately, if VR is going to be successful, it's going to be a far more of a physical thing, where you put on not just goggles, but like some sort of a haptic suit, and you're in an environment, a safe environment, where you're not going to, like, you know, be chasing, you know, as a space marine, you know, chase like Halo creatures out your window and die. I think there have to be a lot more circumstances that A, make it safe and a physical thing. And then, of course, then you're going to have to, you know, measure how much energy you're going to expend. I think once VR reaches that plateau, I'll become interested in it. Although I'd just as soon it goes straight to the holodeck, you know, phase, where you just walk into a room and boom, you're in it.
Well, and, you know, honestly, one of the things that I'm kind of interested in is this notion of the virtual movie theater. Like, I mean, if I can sit on my couch and put something on my face that that truly gives me the immersion of being in a movie theater. That's compelling to me. Now, I think most of the current headsets have a relatively low pixel count that will kind of, I mean, certainly the Oculus, it's a developer kit one, so it's a very low res early build kit. You can almost count the pixels. I mean, it's very grainy. But I love the idea of watching movies in a very immersive way with a giant screen, even if it's a virtual screen, that kind of takes me out of, oh, I can see my phone light up while I'm watching a movie or something. I'm like you, I watch a lot of movies at home. And something that gives me that kind of sense of being immersed while I'm watching video, home video, is something that is kind of compelling to me. But I don't see a whole lot of push for that at the same time. I don't see a whole lot of people talking about that particular experience.
Yeah,
But that's what I want.
I think what you and I want is well on its way, and that ultimately is going to be cool home theater rigs that are just like giant screens, however they're being projected, whether it's on an actual set, or it's being blasted on your wall, or it's on, some filament that, maybe surrounds you and you're just kind of into it, but it's not creating eye strain or things like that where you can really suck it in. I just don't think, as I wear glasses some of the times. I know you do too. Like, I don't want a headset on me on top of that. Like, right away, the idea of like having, a screen a couple inches from my eyeballs is extremely unappealing to me. And I think no matter what happens, like, even if you could experience it now and think it's cool, I just don't think it's a sustainable entertainment experience. And what we always see in these situations is if there is some market penetration and success around this, everything that's going to happen is going to be bad because people are going to rush to use existing games and IPs and go, well, we'll just convert it. This will be the version that we do for VR. We just took this game and kind of just put it through a processor, and it's going to, like, I think crappy material, a flood of crappy material is going to help sink the growth of this tech is my fear, because we've seen that happen over and over.
I think the same way we saw this rush to horrible motion controls around Kinect
Right.
and Wii, you're going to see that on VR as well. It's going to be a huge glut of just pure garbage. Let's talk for a second about kind of Microsoft strategy. I mean, so they've basically merged with the upcoming anniversary update to Windows 10 and the updates to the Xbox. They're kind of merging or trying to merge. This has long been their plan to take over the living room, but the Xbox and PC gaming experience, such that many games will be cross-buy between PC and Xbox. And the Xbox itself now is more of a platform than a console. So Scorpio, will run all Xbox One games, not even backwards compatible. It will just be kind of Xbox as brand as opposed to a particular generation. It will just be like PC now. Like, so if you have a more modern graphics card, you can run PC games at a higher resolution or with better textures. If you have an older PC, you run the same game, but you run it at a lower level. Xbox is going to be that same kind of platform. I know you're not historically a PC gamer. Does that appeal to you? You're also not a backwards compatibility advocate. Does that appeal to you, or does that seem like that's kind of not compelling?
Well, I think ultimately, if that's where the market's going, and certainly the slew of products we just listed suggests that that's where it's going. I think it's a big win for Microsoft, because if they suck Sony into playing a game that they have far more experience in, which is sort of like developing upward to that PC standard, I think that's a big win for them. And if they can get consumers to, look at gaming consoles in the same way they look at their phones, where like every year or two I want to upgrade, that's also a win. Is that a game that interests me? Not really. Like I said, backwards compatibility is not something I've ever kind of thought as a feature that I would ever lay any money into. It's fine if it's there, but it's never been a selling point to me. So, I think what we're seeing is a good thing for Microsoft, not a good thing for Sony, and maybe overall not so great for the consumer.
Well, it's kind of interesting. I mean, they attempted backwards compatibility with the 360 to the original OG Xbox, and it was pretty bad. It was very much an emulatory experience. I mean, they had changed graphics chipsets, they had changed processors. It was a very complicated process to emulate, and it overwhelmingly didn't work. So if you went back and played a lot of Xbox One games on the, I'm sorry, Xbox original games on the 360, you had a pretty substandard experience compared to what the actual physical hardware would have given you. My experience with the backwards compatibility for 360 to Xbox One has been much better. Technologically, I think that's because they've moved the Xbox One to basically just be a PC, and they're effectively running a 360 virtual machine inside of Windows 10 on the Xbox. So it's like they're doing a lot of kind of technical shenanigans that have made that process really work. I finished Black Ops. I actually had never finished the original Call of Duty Black Ops on 360. I kind of liked the game. Something else came out, and I just got pulled away. And honestly, frame rate wise, and I mean, I would never have known that I wasn't playing on an original Xbox. So I really do feel like they figured it out, and they do have, PC game developers have a long history of kind of working with a large number of levels of graphical fidelity and different kinds of hardware. So I think you're right. They are kind of uniquely qualified to do this. It will just be kind of interesting to see if people will be willing to upgrade their consoles more frequently. I mean, the Xbox 360 lived now for 10 years, right? It just stopped being developed. And certainly Nintendo's consoles prior to the Wii U had very long lifespans, and the PS2 had a, I don't know, like a 12-year lifespan. It had an insanely long lifespan. So it'll be interesting to see if people will kind of move forward, or if we'll have this kind of fractured experience, and what that will be like, because I honestly don't know, as what developers will cop to, if they'll go to the newest hardware and optimize for it, or if they'll kind of stick with where the most people are.
I suspect the latter, but I guess we will see.
We will see. All right.
Okay.
Okay, everyone, that is our show for this week. Thank you so much for joining us. Adam, I hope you have a great week. We'll see you next time.
Thanks, dude.
All right. Please be sure to subscribe to us on Google Play, on iTunes, or on SoundCloud, and to follow us at Zod Podcast. If you have any topics you'd like us to cover in the future, please let us know as well. And as always, we love feedback and reviews. Adam, take care.
Thanks, buddy.
Bye, everybody.